Hello, hello, hello. Here's Malanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, Essays Divine and Human. Continuing with the topic Truth, Sat. What dwells only in the perfect light? The perfect and unfailing bliss. However, three illegitimate human activities, of which philosophy, religion, and science have severally made themselves guilty, the disputatious metaphysical philosophy of the schools, the theology of the churches, and the scientific philosophy of the laboratories. Philosophy, religion, and science have each their appointed field and dominion, and each can help man in his great preoccupation, the attempt to know all that he can about Sat, about Brahman. The business of philosophy is to arrange logically the general modes of Sat. The business of religion is to arrange practically and vitally the personal relations of Sat. And the business of science is to arrange observantly and analytically the particular forms and movements of Sat. Now, they are really necessary to and ought to lean on one another. And if all recognized proper limitations and boundary marks could, by their joint activity, help man to his present attainable fullness. But by a sort of intellectual land hunger, they are perpetual invaders of each other's dominion, and they deny each other's positions, and therefore remain unprofitably at war through the human ages. Finally, all three, after illegitimately occupying each other's fields, insist on snatching at a knowledge of which they are all equally incapable: the essential nature of the world, the secret reality of Sat, the Uttamam Rahasyam of the Brahman. And this error, this confusion, this sankra, or illegitimate mixing of different nature and function, is the curse of the Kali. And from it arises much, if not most, of the difficulty we experience as a race in escaping from this misery and darkness into bliss and light. It is part, and a great part, of Kali Kalila, the chaos of the Kali. India has always attempted, though not since the confusion of Buddhism with any success, if not to keep the three to their proper division of labor, which, with the general growth of ignorance, became impossible, at least always to maintain or reestablish, if disturbed, some harmony between them. Of this attempt, the Gita is the standing monument and the most perfect example. To see the confusion working in its untrammeled force, and it is only so by isolating the disease from the modification of curative forces, that we can observe, diagnose, and afterwards find its remedy, we must go to the intellectual history of the European continent. There have been, properly speaking, two critical periods in this history: the Greco-Roman era of philosophic illumination previous to Christianity, and the era of modern scientific illumination, which is still unexhausted. In the first, we see the revolt of philosophy, with science concealed in her protective embrace, against the usurpation of religion. We find it, after achieving liberation, in its turn denying religion and usurping her sacred prerogative. In the modern era, we see science, this time emerged and adult, keeping philosophy behind her, in revolt against religion, first liberate herself, then deny religion and usurp her prerogatives. Then, or as part of this final process of conquest, turn, deny, and strike down her lofty ally and usurp also her ancient territory. For science has scorned and denied religion, she has equally scorned and denied metaphysics. If she has declared God to be a barbarous myth, a fiction of dreams and terrors and longings, and denied us the right of communion with the infinite, equally has she declared metaphysics to be an aberration of the ideative faculty, a false extension of logic, and denied our right to recognize any metaphysical existence or anything at all which cannot be judged by or inferred from the results of the test tube, the scalpel, the microscope, and the telescope. Neither, however, has she herself hesitated to dogmatize about the essential nature of existence and the mutual relations of its general modes, matter, life, mind, and spirit. But for our immediate purpose, it is only necessary to note the result in either of these eras of these tremendous usurpations. The result of usurpations of philosophy was that mankind flung itself with an infinite sincerity, with a passionate sense of relief, into the religion of an obscure Jewish sect and consented for a length of time which amazes us to every theological absurdity, even the most monstrous, so that it might once more be permitted to believe in something greater than earth and to have relations with God. The old philosophical spirit was torn to pieces with Hypatia in the blood-stained streets of Alexandria. Theology usurped her place and discoursed blindly and foolishly on transubstantiation and consubstantiality and one knows not what other barren mysteries. So far as philosophy was allowed an independent existence, she was compelled to do not her own work, but the work of science. So we find the schoolmen elaborately determining by logic and a priori word-fencing questions, which could only be properly determined by observation and analysis. For theology, for medieval religion herself did not care for this field of knowledge. She had no need for scientific truths, just as the Jacobin Republic had no need of chemists. In fact, she guillotined science wherever its presence attracted her attention. But all injustice, and that means at bottom all denial of truth, of the satyam and ritam, brings about its own punishment, or, as religion would put it, God's visitation and vengeance. Science liberated, given in her strenuous emergence the strength of the Titans, avenges herself today on her old oppressors, religion, philosophy, breaks their temples, scorns their gods and prophets, and seeks to deprive them even of the right to existence. Well, that was the result of the Greco-Roman Illumination. And what will be the result of the scientific illumination, the modern enlightenment, the fiery triumph and ardent intellectual bigotry of the materialist? It's too early to foresee the final denouement, but unformed lines of it show themselves, and obscure masses arise. mysticism is growing obscurely in strength, as science grew obscurely in strength in the Middle Ages. We see Titanic and mystic figures striding out of the East, building themselves fortresses and points of departure, spreading among the half-intellectual, capturing even the intellectual, vague figures of theosophy, spiritualism, mental science, psychical research, Neo-Hinduism, Neo-Buddhism, Neo-Mohammedism, and Neo-Christianity. The priests of Isis, the adepts and illuminati of Gnosticism, denied their triumph by the intervention of Saint Paul and the Pope. Reborn into this later age, claim now their satisfaction. Already some outworks of materialism are giving way. The attack grows more insistent, the defense more uncertain, less proudly self-confident, though not less angry, contemptuous, bitter, intolerant, and the invaders increase their adherents, extend the number of their strongholds. If no wider and higher truth intervenes, it would almost seem as if the old confusion in a new form might replace the new. Perhaps an esoteric society or a spiritualist circle of high mediums will in a few centuries be laying down for us what we shall think about this world and the next, and what particular relations with gods will be permitted us, what influences or initiates we shall worship. Who knows? The fires of Smithfield may yet reblaze to save heretics from the perdition which an illustrious voice has declared to us to be the destined doom of all who do not acknowledge Maria and Kutumi. These are not mere fantastic speculations. The history of humanity and the peculiar capacities of that apparently incalculable and erratic thing, human nature, ought to warn us of their possibility, or at least that they are not entirely impossible, in spite of the printing press, in spite of the clarities of science. No doubt the old philosophers thought that with so many stoas and academies, such spread of education, never again would enlightenment be dimmed, and the worship of gods and ghosts would be, in the end, amusing, but not vulgar, would in the end amuse none but the vulgar. We must accept these things as possible and examine why they are possible. This reaction is inevitable because philosophy, though exceedingly high and luminous, tends to be exclusive and narrow, and science, though exceedingly patient, accurate, and minute, tends to be limited, dry, and purblind. They are both apt to be as dogmatic and intolerant in their own high way, or in their own clear, dry way, as religion in her way, which is not high, but intense, not clear, but enthusiastic, and they live on a plane of mentality on which humanity at large does not yet find itself at perfect ease, cannot live without a struggle and a difficulty in breathing. They both demand from man sacrifice his heart and his imagination to his intellect, shall deny his full human nature and live coldly and dryly. Well, you might just as well ask man to live without free breathing. This mental world in which we are asked to live resembles what the life of humanity would be if the warmth of the sun had diminished, the earth growing chill, and its atmosphere were already too rarefied for our comfort. It's no use saying that he ought to live in such an atmosphere and that it will improve his mental health and vigor. Perhaps he ought, though I do not think so. But he cannot. Or rather, the individual may, as everything is possible to individual man, but the race cannot. The demand can never be allowed, for it is a denial of nature, a violation of the Great Mother, a displacement of her eternal facts by the aridities of logic, a refusal of the truth of things, of the satyam, ritam, and if it is persisted in, it will bring its own revenges. Philosophy and science, if they're to help mankind without hurting it and themselves, must recognize that mankind is a complex being, and his nature demands that every part of that complexity shall have its field of activity, and every essential aspiration in man must be satisfied. It is his nature and his destiny to be aptakama, satisfied in his desires, in the individual and in the race, though always in accordance with the satyam, the ritam, which is also the sukham and sundaram, not lawlessly and according to aberrations and caprices. It was the great virtue of the ancient Hinduism, before Buddhism upset its balance and other aberrations followed, that it recognized, in principle at least, this fundamental verity, which did not deny what God insists upon, but strove. It does not matter whether perfectly or imperfectly, to put everything in its place and create a natural harmony. I think that's a good place to pause for today's episode. We will continue on this topic in the next episode. Thank you for listening. May your days be filled with light. Bye for now. Marlenka signing off.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.